Welcome to the 130 BPM podcast. It is November 3rd, 2011. My name is Will Ryan. I'm here with the regular guys, Rob and Sean. Say hello.
Yo. What's up?
And our guest today is Eric Berg.
I'm Eric.
Hey, what's up, Eric?
Hello.
How's it going?
It goes well.
Do you do anything cool for Halloween? That was last weekend.
I went to a party where Moby was DJing, but I couldn't get into the room where he was DJing, so I saw Henry Rollins DJ instead, and it was awesome.
Really?
Yeah.
Where was that?
A consolation prize, I guess.
It was at this like massive hotel ballroom. It was held by local LA radio station KCRW. It's really good.
I would much rather see Henry Rollins than Moby, to be frank.
I think I was going to try and see half and half, but then I ended up seeing all of Henry Rollins, which was okay.
What kind of stuff did he play?
He played a weird mix of stuff I can't really remember, to be perfectly honest.
I
remember he played Ace of Spades. That's the one I remember.
Rob, yes. Did you catch them all? Did you go as Ash this year?
Yeah, I went as Ash Ketchum from Pokemon. I bought a Pokeball from Toys R Us. I was surprised that they still sell Pokemon stuff in there. I thought it was gone way out of fashion.
So they celebrate Halloween in Los Angeles.
They do that. Surprising as it is.
Yeah,
in America.
Yeah, I would just get. I don't know what LA is all about, so I just assume it's totally different than where I live. So speaking of Halloween, the Flaming Lips released their 24-hour song, which did anyone listen?
It's certainly scary.
Yeah. Did anyone listen to it at all? Like, any of it?
Yeah.
There aren't enough drugs in the world to get me to do that.
I know.
When you go onto the stream, it's not like you press play and it starts. I think you go onto the stream and you just happen to jump in wherever it happens to be at. Because when I went on there, I just see it in the middle of a bunch of noise, and I listened to that for about 2 minutes, and I got bored, and I left.
Wait, they weren't, like, it's not like an MP3 where you can...
No, it's just streaming on their site.
Oh, I see. So, are they even, like, could you theoretically go and listen to it now, or is it down?
I don't know, to be perfectly honest. One time was enough.
Yeah, I mean, we should have probably done our due diligence, and...
Maybe someone who bought this... Someone who bought the skull will put it online.
Yeah. I thought that was the dumbest thing about it, was the skull. Because I feel like they could have done something cool with, like, giving those away, but they just buy it for $5,000. So, we're kinda...
I want to know whose skull is it?
It's probably just random... it's not going to be anyone famous or you've heard of.
Yeah, I know, but how did they get the rights to use a random human skull, and why wasn't
it Kurt Cobain's skull?
You can probably just, like, yeah, if you can find the right people, you can get a skull, right? The right shady characters.
If you're as cool as Wayne Cohen, you can get a skull.
Yeah, he just has to say the word, and...
Eric, I know for a fact you hate Wayne Cohen.
Yes, this is a fact.
Why do you hate...
Yeah, I think this entire 24-hour song thing is a joke.
It totally is, but, like, at the same time, they totally had to do it, too, which is, like...
Why? What was their other one? Like, a...
Six-hour?
They're, like, in a pissing match with themselves to see who can create the longest song. It's just pointless and stupid.
But, like, do you think they recorded it all in one go, or do you think they, like, they recorded it over... a long period of time, and then just, like, put it together, you know?
Yeah, I'm sure they was done piecemeal. I doubt that they sat down for 24 hours.
I mean, it'd be impressive if they jammed for 24 hours.
Sure.
It'd be that impressive. We know the kind of drugs they do.
Guys, let's podcast for 24 hours.
I've heard of people doing that. It's not...
Have you heard of Afterlife, where the people play video games for 24 hours for charity?
Charity?
Yeah, you can, like, donate to people, and they raise money.
Yeah, it is streaming. I can't tell if you start the song or if you're just jumping in the middle.
Yeah, they might have it on, like, just a continuous loop forever or whatever.
Yeah.
Still, like, from a technical standpoint, I'm at least a little bit impressed, even if I think it is kind of stupid and totally a stunt, but...
Guys, they're being generous, though. The $5,000 includes shipping worldwide. So you don't have to pay for shipping.
Oh, well, that just... I was on the fence about it, but...
I wonder if...
I think that might have solidified the decision.
I just want to... If you're listening to this and you've listened to most of it, give us a call somewhere, wherever we are, and let us know what the hell is happening on that stream, because I'm genuinely interested.
Should I live blog it?
You could try.
24-hour live blog of the Flaming Lips.
That would be...
How do you know where to start? How would you know when you've ended as well? Is it exactly 20?
Oh, that would be a trip if it was cyclical, just forever. I'd like that. But at the same time, I feel like a lot of people are kind of saying the Flaming Lips have just, like, gone off the rails, which totally they have, but, like, it's not like the next album is going to be any less of a Flaming Lips album, I'm guessing.
You're guessing.
And this is nothing
you're,
new.
You're
I mean,
hoping.
What was that album? What's
Zyreka?
Yeah, that album. The concept of that album was borderline. I don't even know. Unhinged, I guess, would be it.
It's borderline insane, but I think overall it was kind of genius.
Yeah, no, it's technically.
Whereas this is definitely insane.
Okay. And then this just happened today. This is kind of the world that we live in. In 2011, Juggalos, fans of Insane Clown Posse, known as Juggalos, were classified as a gang by the FBI, a legitimate gang. So, you know, nothing.
What else do they classify as a gang? Is it like the Bloods and the Crips or something like that?
Yeah. I'm really unhappy about this.
It is kind of discrimination. I mean, they're just fans of a certain band.
To me, the stigma that that Juggalos have is no different from the way everybody was blaming Marilyn Manson for Columbine. And it's just because ICP was a little bit more savvy marketers than Manson was and actually came up with a name for their fans and it stuck. That doesn't mean that just because some of their fans do stupid shit like rob people, that they shouldn't be classified as a gang like the way that the Bloods or the Crips are. That doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, it does seem like a little bit out of this world, absurd. And there's some baffling, even just like quotes that you could lift from the article. There was one, the thing that I found the most like ridiculous was there. It said that Juggalos were moving into New Mexico because of the Native American culture is like drawing them there, which. I don't know. What does that
What
mean?
Does that have to do with anything? Like, when has ICP ever been associated with Native American culture in particular? That is,
I mean,
they want to all go lick frogs and see good God. That's why.
Oh, man. Borderline offensive on this podcast. but it read, I mean, I think it was Yahoo News that we tweeted. And that it read like an Onion article. Like honestly, I almost felt like that's what I was reading. And
well, I had been hearing for a couple of years that they were talking about doing that, just classifying them as a gang in the state of Utah and maybe a couple of other states. And I was just like, okay, well, it's Utah. That doesn't surprise me that they're gonna go after Juggalos like that. But like, actually having the FBI doesn't the FBI have things to do besides going after fans of horrorcore rap groups with clown makeup who rap about magnets and
I think this would be settled if Shaggy Too Dope and what's the other guy's name?
Violent J.
Yeah, Shaggy Too Dope and Violent J just need to get some of the FBI's top agents and bring them as VIP guests to the next gathering of the Juggalos, and they'll see how.
Will there be another gathering of the Juggalos, though? That's the other implication of this story. They probably can't have a gathering of the Juggalos anymore because it'll be an organized gang meeting.
Oh shit! crazy helicopter rides with a juggler.
Not only is this going to rob 15,000 juggalos of a weekend of bonding and diverse live music, but it's going to rob us of getting to see another infomercial. Yeah. That's like one of my favorite yearly traditions now. This is the third year that we're talking about this. Because like in 09, 010, 11, there's always been a new gathering of the Juggalos infomercial, and it's been one of the events of the internet every year.
And they always get insane, like don't they have this year? They have Charlie Sheen and
They had Charlie Sheen host. They had George Clinton play, I believe.
Yeah, they just get like really wacky, like
they had like Coolio and stuff.
They always have their sort of contingent of early 90s rappers. They always will have Coolio, Vanilla Ice. I think MC Hammer has played it a number of times.
Snoop Dogg, I know, hasn't Snoop
Has
Dogg...
Snoop Dogg played it before?
I thought maybe. I don't know. I really have no idea.
I know Warren G played.
But yeah.
But seriously, they are discriminating because any fandom of any band could be considered like a group, especially if they're hardcore ones.
I mean,
but just because they wear like makeup and
Carl Hansen was a hardcore Beatles fan. Wait, are Beatles fans a gang?
Yes.
It's just like religion. There's like the wacky fringe of every religion that, you know, gets the news, the notoriety in the news, but that doesn't speak for 99% of people of that religion. Fan bases for bands are the same way. For them to go out and decide that anybody who self-identifies as a juggalo, which is a whole lot of people, you know, of a certain demographic, it doesn't make any sense at all to me.
Yeah, it's like saying that like all like Canucks fans should be. I understand that it's Canada versus the United States, but like all these fans should be monitored by whatever sort of FBI they have in Canada.
Oh, you're talking about rioting after this.
Yeah, it's like, I mean, this whole argument is kind of stupid because like, what does it really mean to a juggalo? Like, what's really
another sports example? Do those lunatics who beat up that Giants fan outside of Dodger Stadium? Do they represent all Dodgers fans? No.
No, but
yeah, the more we deconstruct it, the more absurd it just and tangential it sounds.
It's absurd, but then at the same time, it's like, well, what does this really mean? Like, if I'm like, hey, I'm a juggalo,
yeah,
what does that mean? Like, what's really going to happen to me? Well, nothing.
Going to get tailed by the FBI putting some data.
Yeah,
this.
Black vans are going to follow me wherever I go, and they're going to tap me. You know, it's like, well, no.
I guess it's just another box for them to tick off to profile people. I don't know. So
maybe we should show juggalo solidarity by all dressing up as juggalos for one day.
I'm
seriously considering buying a hatchet chain and just starting to wear it every day.
Unironically, just
yeah. I have nothing against ICP. They have some songs that I like Miracles and Juggalo Island. And Homies, Homies is a good song too. But like, and I just love the way that Violent J and Shaggy 2 Dope have just sort of come up with this entire world of, it's sort of like this, it's sort of the Scientology of music in a way. You sort of have to respect the way that they've just sort of came up with this dark carnival thing, and they've gotten people to believe it for, you know, coming up on 20 years, if not more than 20 years. And
wow!
And you know they pull in millions every year. They sell out everywhere they play. They consistently sell records because they have the kind of fans that buy physical products and don't download. They have like the most brand loyalty fans, like up there with the Grateful Dead and Fish and anybody else who has diehard fans, in my mind.
Yeah, it's pretty insane that they've had, you know, like you said, 20 years, going on 20 years. For been around that long, it seems like they were kind of onto a lot of what you know the internet should have brought, but they've completely devoid of that style of, you know, distribution or whatever.
And they completely exist outside of
right
any kind of critical. Like I actually this summer I watched all 45 minutes of the seminar that Violent J and Shaggy 2 Dope gave at the Gathering of the Juggalos, because I guess seminars are like a thing that they do there where they just do Q&A sessions with the artists. And one of the things that Violent J said during this, and it's on YouTube if anybody wants to check it out, it's kind of interesting to watch, but they said that whenever you read a review of one of their albums by like a serious music critic, they'll always give it a bad review and say, well, Juggalos like it, but that doesn't matter. And Violent J said, no, Juggalos are the only people that matter if they like their record. Like they're not trying to appeal to, they're not the ICP. The thing I respect about them is they're not trying to be anything. They're not, they know that they have their audience and they know what their audience wants and they give it to them.
And that's a very,
and I think that to me, there's something admirable about that. I think the fact that they have a sense of humor about the mainstream sort of catching on to it helps a lot, because I know I've read interviews with Violent J and with Shaggy 2 Dope before where they're talking about the SNL parodies of Miracles and of the Gathering Infomercial. They're all just like, hey, that stuff is hilarious. I'd love to actually be on SNL one time. Like they sort of laugh this stuff off, and they like that the mainstream is sort of starting to come to accept them. And I think that's a good attitude for them to have.
And then it all ends with that Jack White collaboration.
I know, like I remember because I read when that came out, they interviewed them about, and apparently it was Jack White that approached them about doing it. And
yeah,
he said, you know, I go to your website. What was he said? He's like, I go to your website, and there are some things that I can't stand, and some things that I think are absolutely genius.
Yeah. And he just, like, though I feel like the way, or I read that, the way he came up with the kind of collaboration in his head was he just met them in, like, an airport or something, and then he just started thinking, like, yeah, I should just collaborate with, like, it seems so.
And what he ended up coming up with was a song about referencing how Mozart had a very scatological sense of humor, and it's kind of genius.
It's interesting, if nothing else. So that there's our ICP discussion for y'all.
Whoop, whoop.
And our last news piece is sort of out of nowhere indie darling Lana Del Rey is signed to Interscope, and her album's coming out early 2012. So I wanted to mention that because I feel like us reporting on that is like one of the most egregious examples of kind of the indie hype circle a little bit. I mean, I feel like maybe it's a little bit past the point to bring up any problems with Lana Del Rey as like a controversy, but there's something about it that I just can't wrap my head around. Do you guys know even what I'm talking about?
It yes, sounds, yes, just, let's her, move her on.
Entire, I know exactly what we're talking about. The entire Lana Del Rey product just seems like something that somebody came up with as a parody of the way that the indie blogosphere hype spans up.
But we're all sucked into it now. I mean,
I don't think it's a parody as much as it is like a cashing in on.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think her music is any good at all, but...
I think it's all right, but there just seems to be... Either it's just handled poorly, or there's just this odd disconnect between, you know, how much hype she's gotten and how much music she's made. She has like three songs, and the fact that we're kind of
no, she has more than three songs. Or yeah, she has a whole album out.
But under the this kind of new persona or whatever, she has kind of. Is that correct? She only has three songs under, like, the Lana Del Rey
yeah.
persona?
There's definitely something funny going on, because there's no way she should be getting this much hype from places like Pitchfork.
And yeah, that's the only thing that really bothers me. It's not... I don't really hate her or hate her music. There's just something very strange that I've never really encountered in, like, our circle of hype. It seems... Like I said, there's, like, a disconnect, but at the same time, like, we've all... totally bought into it. I mean,
no, I don't think there's a disconnect. We've seen this with
all. I haven't bought into it. I barely knew who she was until a couple.
No, but I mean, we're reporting on it. We're going ahead. We're kind of just like, yeah, this album's coming out early 2012. you should know about this because we are posting about it. And like, it's and didn't she won some award for Q magazine, right?
Yeah, like best nose job or something like that.
All right, let's just move on. All right, so let's talk about what we've been listening to.
Can we talk about Ben and Zoe?
Oh, you wanna you
rest in peace. Rest in peace.
All right, so Ben Gibbard and Zoe Deschanel broke up or split after 2 years of marriage. So I don't have any opinion on this. So everyone else, go ahead.
It's I can't stand the either of them, but it's more important and more interesting to me than Lana Del Rey.
My theory is that they just sort of realized that Carl's and Hipster Runoff weren't very much included in the coverage this week of Kim Kardashian's divorce, and so they just sort of did that because they wanted to give the indie sphere an equivalent.
Man, this I just realized this news segment has been so cynical. Other than the ICP thing, we just been totally ripping on it.
I told you. I said, welcome to the hate cast.
Yeah, this has been not a very happy news week.
Hey, Merry Christmas to them, though. Am I right?
Yeah,
a lot of people. I mean, the positive that obviously a lot of people are taking from this is that Zoe Deschanel is back on the market. So.
Who has that?
I don't know. I've seen like 10 different people tweet that or post that.
The other one is hopefully now Ben will be sad again and start writing good songs again.
I've never been a huge Death Cab fan to begin with, so I can't really speak to that. But
that's the band he's in, right?
Yeah.
Yes, that's the band he's
Man,
in.
Man, you're laying it on thick. All right, does anyone have anything more to say about marriages and all that bullshit?
Who's going to be the next celebrity couple to split?
To be fair, I was literally, when Thurston and Kim announced split, I was actually sort of like, I had to take stock of things a little bit.
Did you guys see on Grantland today, they have a fantasy league now for who's going to be Kim Kardashian's next spouse.
I feel shitty even, yeah, let's just move on. let's talk about what we've been listening to. Rob, what have you been listening to?
I have been listening to the new Florence and the Machine albums, Stone Free Bills. Which is her second album. And I mostly listened to it because it seems this time around a lot more like indie hype than last time. And well, over here anyway, because I was in the UK when the last one came out, and it got a lot of love in the mainstream, and it won like a million awards. I never realized that people who like indie music also cared about it, which surprised me. So I thought I'd check it out, even though I never didn't really like her. And you know, I like quite a few of the songs, but mostly I think it's kind of boring and overproduced and almost a retread of the first album, but with a few more instruments. And the whole thing is just centered around her voice, and her voice is really good, but after almost an hour of listening to it, it's very grating and boring and the same and insipid. And I make it sound like I really hate this album, but I actually don't. And I don't know, I wish she'd like got. She's way more popular than someone like Bat for Lashes, who I think does something very similar and does it much, much better than she does. I think also Karen from Bat for Lashes has a much better voice too. And she's got like the nouse to get people like, Scott, what's his face? Scott Walker on her album and Yeysayer and people like that and make it interesting, whereas Florence the Machine is just, you know.
I listened to it for the first time just before we started recording, and I didn't listen to the first one, and this is the first time I've kind of listened to any of their material, and my first thought was like, poor woman's, I guess, back of lashes. And the similarity is almost like too line for line. Like her vocal dynamics, like her breath and the way she comes off some of the words sounds like she's trying to say. And actually my only exposure of Bat for Lashes, Florence and the Machine, before listening to them was the when she got in trouble for lifting from Gang Gang Dance. And I really had no context for that because I had never heard the song that she put the Gang Gang Dance, like, coda or whatever it was into. And, like, now I totally see how that, you know, works, because she sounds so... I mean, it's very inoffensive, and I can see why people like it. It's pretty standard pop songwriting. But I feel like she's grabbing from all these like, contemporary indie musicians that do it better. And seeing that Gang Gang Dance thing, it makes sense to me how, you know, it sounds like that. It sounds like she's kind of... I'd go as far as say stealing, because it's like I said, it's inoffensive, but it almost offends me how derivative it is. And like you said, her voice is very it's good, like you said, but it's very uninteresting. It's very she goes for kind of soaring and you know, that pop kind of bombast, where a lot of, you know, the artists that she's kind of taking nods from go for something a little bit more understated. So
yeah, you're right, she just takes a lot of what's out there in the indie music landscape and homogenizes it down into a pill that's easy to swallow.
And the thing that's crazy is that so many of my favorite records this year are by women. Like, if you think about the Bjork album, which we've talked about before, the St. Vincent album is definitely one of my favorites. That group, The Do, The Doe,
The Doe.
You know who I'm talking, yeah, them, like, that's great. And then I even really like the album Tori Amos put out this year. I don't think anybody really talked about that because I don't know how in she is anymore, but her album this year was really solid. And it's just there's so many people like that you'd have to go down on this list for me before Florence and the Machine would be something I'd be interested in. It's not that I necessarily dislike her, it's just there's so much better, like you guys said, there's so much better stuff than her out there. That
yeah. Right. And now with Kate Bush and Mazzy
Storm.
Yeah,
and of course, Kate's coming out with a new album, and of course I'm going to be all over that the minute it happens.
And that comparison, like, offends me, how critics are like, oh yeah, she's obviously influenced by Kate Bush. It's like, you're undermining...
Because every slightly off-kilter female singer of the last 30 years has been influenced by Kate Bush.
Had that influence thrown at them.
Exactly. Just in the same way that every terrible singer-songwriter in the 60s and 70s was influenced by Bob Dylan. Kate Bush is just sort of the lazy go-to you know, comparison, and she's just on a different level from... I mean, I guess you can make an... I think Bjork has sort of transcended that tag, and to a lesser extent, Tori Amos has also. But Kate, to me, is just on such a different level from any of these people that anytime her name gets brought into one of these things, it's just... Yeah, it's offensive. It's offensive, and it's lazy, and I wish people would stop doing it.
Yeah, I wish you're right, though. I hope that people who listen to Florence and the Machine, and maybe they're a little disappointed by it, or they want to try something else like it. All they have to look as far as go a little bit outside of their comfort zone for something like St. Vincent.
Get the St. Vincent.
Or PJ Harvey, and
why do they have to listen to women?
Well, I mean, it's just if they like... Florence and the Machine is very woman's, like, if you like, it's like the quintessential women's pop, I think. So I mean, I don't know, but I mean, yeah, that's true, they don't have to do that either, but it's easy. We're being lazy now, like, just how we were saying, it's lazy to throw the Kate Bush tagged on anyone.
Now you're saying it's quintessential women's pop. Exactly, like, what does that even mean?
Yeah, no, I mean, if you want to listen to a female alternative pop singer, like, Florence and the Machine is an easy pick, that's what I'm saying.
But I feel like she has more in common with kind of just the standard pop idol than she ever would with Kate Bush, which is why I feel like that comparison is, like, really offensive to someone, like, who loves Kate Bush a lot and feels for music shouldn't just be thrown around for influence.
The thing is now, today, Kate Bush is like, because her music was so good back then, today people kind of think that that's what pop music was, and she brought it out, but
yeah,
it wasn't
really. This is actually crazy. When I was in London this summer, I was at the British Music Experience Museum that's in the O2 Arena, and I was looking around, and in the 1980s room, one of the displays that they had was from about 1985. It was like Kate Bush and Madonna battle for pop supremacy, and that just blew my mind, because like I've never met another person outside of our music circle who even knows who Kate is, and like she's been one of my absolute favorite artists in the world for many years, but the fact that she was actually big enough to ever be mentioned in the same sentence with Madonna in the UK is just crazy to me. I mean, it's awesome, don't get me wrong, but I just that really took me back a little bit.
Yeah, certainly not like that here at all. I mean, I rarely meet anyone who knows who Kate Bush is, you know. And to throw her to, I think it's just one of those examples of where someone who is derivative and kind of a watered down display of all these kind of better contemporary artists, then everyone kind of go, and the people who have the, you know, the platform on which like they are actually tastemakers, they go and kind of like Rolling Stone gave that album a really positive review. And
but they gave everything a positive review. They gave Lou Reed and Metallica 3 stars yesterday.
Did they?
The BBC gave Metallica 8 out of 10. I was shocked.
No, but yeah, you're right.
I'm pretty sure Rolling Stone just gives 3 or 3.5 stars to everything that isn't Bruce Springsteen or U2, because those are an automatic 5 star, and everything else they're just sort of go somewhere in the middle just so that they don't offend anybody one way or the other.
Yeah, Rolling Stone is very strange. Like, didn't they give that Bob Dylan Christmas album like 5 stars or something?
Probably. Okay. Are we really
wasting our time on Rolling Stone?
Yeah, we are.
All right, ultimate word on Florence and the Machine, if you think of listening to it, or listen to one of the other albums we mentioned instead.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Go pick up a Kate Bush album. Go pick up every Kate Bush album.
Go listen to other women.
Just all of them. All of the other women.
Don't listen to a man, though. You will hate him.
Sean, what have you been listening to?
I've been sort of immersing myself. I'm going to have a pretty big feature coming up about it this week. That's, you know, review, feature, you know, take your pick, whatever it is going to be. But I've been sort of immersing myself in the 20th anniversary super duper deluxe version of Achtung Baby, obviously the U2 album. Came out in 1991, which I'm sure you guys are all familiar with.
Sean, for your money, is it the best U2 album?
It's the best rock album of the last 25 years.
Wow.
Really?
I like the Joshua Tree more.
It's... No, I would put Achtung Baby up there with anything you can name. I'd put it up there with Nevermind. I'd put it up there with OK Computer. I'd put it up there with Appetite for Destruction. Put it up there with Funeral. Any album like that that you could name, I would put Achtung Baby up against it.
All right, let's do this right now. Let's settle 25 years of music.
It's not gonna happen.
But that's a pointless exercise.
It is. But anyway. I've been listening to the album, of course, which is fantastic. And then also, I've been watching the I watched the documentary that came with it that was directed by David Guggenheim, who did that documentary with The Edge and Jack White and Jimmy Page. He directed that, and he directed this new documentary called From the Sky Down that's just sort of U2 looking back on the making of Achtung Baby and performing some of the songs now and also playing back some of the studio tapes, and so that's been really interesting. And I've been listening to a lot of the outtakes and B-sides that are on the bonus discs of this deluxe edition, and I've also been rereading this book that's, to me, it's one of the great rock biographies ever written. It's this one, it's by Bill Flanagan. It's called U2 at the End of the World, and it's basically just chronicling the 3 years that encompassed the making of Octoon Baby through the end of the Zoo TV tour, which, if you guys have never seen the DVD of the video of that or any footage of it, just like go on YouTube or something. It's one of the most, even today, it's one of the most technologically impressive rock performances ever staged. And the thing that, I mean, a lot of people probably will know this who are listening, but for those who don't, the sort of just to set up Octoon Baby, U2, you know, in 1987 they released the Joshua Tree, which made them the kind of international superstars that they've basically been since then. And so then around then they started playing stadiums. They stopped playing arenas, they started playing stadiums. And at first they just didn't really know how to adjust to that, like, because they kept, the expectations were on them, and they seemed like they weren't really clicking on stage, having to play to these massive crowds. And they just felt like their act and their music had just gotten way too self-indulgent, so they just sort of took a step back and completely, I guess, hit the reset button on really their entire sound and their entire aesthetic. And they, you know, took a lot of influence. They used to be more influenced by punk and by, later in the 80s, American blues and roots music. They took a lot more inspiration later and during the making of Octoon Baby from hip-hop, from electronic music, from industrial music, from a lot of European dance music. And they just sort of, it was just a totally different look. They sort of developed a little bit more of a sense of humor about themselves, and I mean, they wrote some of the, obviously, some of the greatest songs they've ever written. One, Mysterious Ways, The Fly, Zoo Station, Who's Gonna Ride Your Wild Horses. The whole album is incredible, and it's been thought of as a classic by basically everybody. So I'm sure a lot of people have heard it, but if you haven't, it's kind of imperative that you get it.
So are they just reissuing that one album, or is it?
Well, they've been doing this for a while. They over the last 5 or 6 years, they've reissued all of their albums up to that point.
Oh, it's like kind of an anniversary
thing.
All of 80s
albums. They haven't done a huge box set. I think they did something a little bit less than this to the Joshua Tree, but they've never done anything to this extent. This thing is, I don't actually.
So what's in it? What's included in the package?
It's 6 CDs and 4 DVDs. And so it's got Octoon Baby on one disc, and then it's got Zooropa, which is their album that they put out in about 1993, on the next disc, because they included that in the box set because it was recorded during the same sessions, and they started playing a lot of those songs on the Zoo TV tour, so it was sort of part of the same era. It's sort of a Kid A Amnesiac situation for all you Radiohead fans out there, so that's why they sort of included that in the box set. And then there's a couple of discs of just, like, remixes of the Octoon Baby songs by different DJs that aren't really that interesting to me. But then there's the disc of B-sides, which has a lot of great stuff on it. And then there's a disc that has an alternate version of every song on the album. And that, to me, is the really interesting thing, because you get to see sort of how all the songs developed. Because it's sort of a case of spot the influencer, because the album that they put out is you know, totally unique sounding. It's the kind of sound you hear, you immediately identify it as, oh, that's U2's Octoon Baby era sound. But on some of these early versions of the songs, like Even Better Than the Real Thing, for example, it started off as sort of a Stones ripoff, or Who's Gonna Ride Your Wild Horses sounded like it was kind of a Bruce Springsteen homage. And so it's kind of interesting to see the way the songs developed like that.
So definitely worth it for folks like you, who are kind of obsessed with that record.
Yeah, and it, at the very minimum, if anybody doesn't have Octoon Baby, download it or buy it or something. Just buy the CD of it without any of the bonus stuff if you don't care about that stuff. But that's the kind of album that should be. I've never read one of those 1001 albums you must hear before you die books, but that's the kind of album that I would imagine would have to be in it. Or at least that's an album that I'd put in it.
Eric, what have you been listening to?
I have been listening to something not quite as lofty as Octoon Baby. I've been listening to the Danny Brown and Black Milk collaborative hip-hop album, Black and Brown.
is it?
It's good. It's very good. I like it a lot. I've been a fan of Black Milk's for a long time now. He's produced like, yeah, a million different albums, and yeah, I've always really liked his stuff. And Danny Brown, obviously, like, a huge player in the hip hop world this year, like the indie hip hop, whatever.
Blog.
Is it just me, or has this been an exceptionally good year for new rappers coming out, sort of, from the blog world? I'm not even, not like, well, even discounting the whole Odd Future thing. You've got Danny Brown, you've got Kendrick Lamar that's really come on this year.
Action Bronson.
Action Bronson.
Yeah, there are a lot that suck, like Action Bronson and that Aesop Rocky guy. And then...
you don't like Action Bronson?
No, no. But there are good ones this year. Big Crit.
Well,
yeah, not created great.
Not to throw a wrench in the party, but I like can't stand Danny Brown. I sort of hate him.
Well, no. Here's the thing. Here's the thing, is that Triple X is not a good album. I don't like Triple X.
Oh, really?
But I like this other stuff that he's done. Like, he had a verse on that Mr. Motherfucking Esquire remix song with like a million different artists. And that was a really good verse. And then this album's really good. Like, I think maybe it's just because I like Black Milk and whatever, but I didn't like Triple X at all. And I think this album's really good.
Yeah, I could barely get through Triple X. So, what are Black Milk's credentials? I'm kind of ignorant.
He's done stuff with... He used to be in Slum Village, which is like a collective.
Oh, okay. I know Slum Village, yeah.
Yeah. A collective of a bunch of different rappers, and then he's produced for like Royce da 5'9" and Elzai. He,
a lot of Detroit people like that.
Yeah, he produced a track on Pro Tools, the
GZA
album. Yeah, he's done a ton of different things. Like, I have his Wikipedia for his production history pulled up here, and it's like super long. Like, there's rapper Big Pooh. Who else do we have here?
Oh, so KRS-One,
you know, it's just Buff One. Like, there's Sky Zoo. There's a lot of different rappers.
So is that I mean, we just talking about blog rap. That's not a mixtape, is it? Or like XXX was a
no.
Mixtape?
No.
XXX. I mean, he released it for free, but I think he considers it an album.
Right. I mean, that, yeah, mixtape is kind of just the delivery.
Yeah, I think from everything I've seen that it's more of a real album than a mixtape, but who knows with Black Milk. Like, half the stuff Black Milk's done has been mixtapes. Like, he got, like, one of his most famous ones, I think it was, like, 2007 when he did Caltroit, or no, 2008. It was Caltroit, which won, like, Best Mixtape of the Year in a bunch of different places, and that was, like, kind of what garnered him a lot of attention. But, yeah, I think it's a real album. I don't know if you can, like, go out and buy it, per se.
Yeah, it's
but
crazy.
I don't think it's billed as a mixtape.
Alright. I mean, it's crazy that we've gotten to the point. I feel like the hip hop artists that have kind of made a stand this year or whatever have really come in the form of mixtapes, like being things over the internet versus albums in stores or whatever.
I just hate the term mixtape just applying to anything that's a free album, because to me, I might just be old school, but when I hear the word mixtape in regards to rap, I think of, you know, just sort of a not like anything that's not like sequenced like an album. Like, if somebody's like rapping
right
over another like instrumentals for songs that have already been released, or
I totally agree with you, and like,
no,
that,
like that. Anything if something feels like it was sequenced and enough effort was put into it that like if you were listening to it in a vacuum you would think it was an album. I consider it an album.
That was kind of the Dream's point when he put out 1977 for free.
Yeah, exactly. Or like, what about The Weeknd?
Right.
The Weeknd officially considers those things to be mixtapes, but it's like, no, they're as well produced and well sequenced and well crafted as any album I've ever heard in the last several years. So.
Better than most albums, for sure.
And so, like, for example, like Lil Wayne, that I Am Not a Human Being that he released, that was it technically a mixtape or was that an album? It's because they gave it away for free.
All right, this is my segment, and I outlaw all Lil Wayne talk.
You're gonna veto that? I mean, I was making a point, but okay. I mean, I'm okay with that.
I just hit my gavel against the desk.
Skeet, 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 water gun. That's all I'm gonna add.
Oh man, it's gotten violent in this Skype party.
No, I was just quoting Lil Wayne's version of Drake song that came out yesterday.
Oh yeah.
In which he shouts out Mac Dre, which kind of made my part of my soul die a little bit.
But yeah, I mean that's kind of been a sea change since, you know, mid last decade is the mixtape, quote unquote, turning into just like a free album, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah, here's the thing. You may not like Danny Brown, and I get that, because I didn't either, but this album's really good, and you should check it out.
All right, I'm going to check it out.
Me? Why not?
That's true. All right, is that all you have to say about Black and Brown?
Yes.
Shut up, Rob. Maybe I want to talk more about it.
Do you?
No, I'm good.
So I've been listening...
What have you been listening to, Will?
I have been listening to Oniotrix Point Never's new album, which is called Replica. And I like it a lot. I'm a fan of his. I've actually kind of felt like he has been a little bit overhyped. I mean, Riffs, which came out in 2009 and was like a collection of his previous three albums. I mean, it's great, but I feel like it's pretty straightforward compared to the stuff that he's been doing in the last 2 years. And then Returnal last year was also great, but and it kind of, you know, had some progression to it. He obviously is kind of heading towards something that's a little bit less kind of ambient and atmospheric and a little bit more. There's actually some songwriting going on. And Replica kind of takes it to this... It takes it to a really different place, and a lot of it's not... It's all... I mean, there's no beats to it, but a lot of it is very kind of arranged, and I actually thought a lot of it could compare to something, you know, like that would come out on, like, the Brainfeeder record label. Except, you know, without drums, without programming, and it's very much like sound collage-y. And I mean, his synth style is still intact, but he's obviously doing something that's really different than what he's done before. And I feel like this is kind of the first time where he's actually kind of living up to the hype that has been preceding him for almost, you know, since Riffs came out. Have any of you guys listened to it?
Yeah, I have.
Have not.
What do you think?
Thoughts are. All the tracks are really good, and I really like the weird sounding ones are kind of harder to get into, but I love the more briny, you know, ambient-y ones, like the opening track, Andrew. But my problem with it is, like, I love ambient music, but for me it has to all fit into one theme and like flow. It's something like Flying Lotus's last album, like you were saying about the Brainfield,
like Tycho.
Or Tycho, or even Brian Eno, like, they all flow and they're all of a piece. I feel like these are 10 different songs from very different areas, and they don't really fit together very well. That's my problem with it. While they're all really interesting, I can't get into this album because, you know, it's just like I'm in one mood and then all of a sudden I'm hearing something completely different.
Yeah, I feel like he's kind of... I mean, I don't know if I totally agree with you about it not being one mood, but I feel like he is kind of changing it up to the point where it's less of a, you know, atmospheric kind of ambient album. It's more like in a very arranged ambient album. I mean, he's got, I mean, a lot of piano stuff, and obviously the synths are there, but he also has like a lot of samples and vocal samples, and some of it is kind of like a little bit, you know, inaccessible and challenging to get into, I think. And
right, the samples he uses are like jarring and stuff, which is cool. If he made a whole album of stuff like that, it'd be easier to get into. But like when a track like that comes along in the middle of something a little more calm, between two like calm tracks, it like throws the balance off for me. And it takes me out of the album.
But I think like there's a song, I think it's the middle song, or it's the sixth track, is NASA, and it's a lot of that like kind of like it's almost a glitchy kind of production style, and then it kind of like there's a kind of like a very specific end to the busy stuff, and it just kind of floats on with the synth stuff, and I think in that sense. Like, it kind of works as like a song more than just, you know, tones or whatever. And
yeah,
and I'm interested to see what people think of it, like, because I think it is pretty different than just like your normal drone synth album.
Rob, would I like this album?
I can never tell what you like, Eric. I've heard about this.
Is it a guy?
Yeah.
Yes.
So I feel like I would like this guy, and the only reason I haven't listened to him is because I really hate the name. But
they actually prefer to be called OPT, apparently, like, because too many people pronounce it wrong.
Gag.
So call him OPT.
Anyway, I feel like this is something I would like kind of experimental, like, is it like sort of electronic, like land,
yeah,
like,
yeah,
oh, yeah, soundscapey kind of. See, I feel like this is something I would like, but I don't know.
That's the problem. Like, half of it's soundscapey, and then the other half is like sample driven, and it, like, throws me out. We should also say it's quite a scary sounding album. I was listening to it earlier with Phil Casares, and he said this is what nightmares sound like,
and not in a good Phil. Said he's never really been into the Oniotrix guy. Oniotrix man.
Well, this is the first Oniotrix I've listened to as well.
Oh, really? Did you go back and listen to Returnal at all, or Riffs?
Not yet, and I haven't listened to the Ford Lopatin album either.
It's very, it's different. Like,
Is it like Ford and Lopatin?
Yeah, well, he's the guy. He's Lopatin from Ford and Lopatin.
Oh, really? Because I like that album a lot.
I actually don't like that album, so. There you go. I mean, like, and the reason why I say that is because, like, was Games the same thing as Ford and Lumberton?
Yeah.
So, yeah, like, yeah. I've never really been able to get into his, like, beat stuff, but I feel like you should maybe start with Returnal, and that's all just basic. I mean, it's not basic, but it's soundscapey stuff versus this, which is definitely something a little bit middle ground between just, like, kind of an electronic album and an ambient album. And
well, your boy Colin Joyce, who you did the M83 discussion with, really likes this album too, so you should talk to him about it.
I will go talk to him about it. Thank you very much. yeah, so I like it a lot. I think Rob's sort of right about everything that he said.
As usual.
Yeah, I mean, not just about Oniotrix. I was just speaking this whole podcast.
Except for double albums.
Yes, double albums are a blank spot in my knowledge.
Actually, did you hear the Anthony collab with Oniotrix last year?
I did not.
Anthony?
Anthony Hegarty, you mean?
Yeah.
I think it is Anthony.
Yeah, go check that. It's so good. And it's like, it's just a piano ballad, but it's, yeah. That's where I'd start with him, and then everything else is completely different, but there you go.
You guys, is Anthony a boy or a girl? Can we have that discussion?
What do you think?
I think I don't know. I think I want to know.
Alright. What? What are we talking about? He has a pretty deep
I'm not going to touch that one.
Yeah.
Eric's nuts.
I gotta say, just as I'm gonna edit this out, it's gonna take forever to edit this podcast. It's been such a fucking mess.
Mostly because of Eric throwing in random things.
The listeners are gonna love this. Don't edit this out. Listeners, you love me and you know it. You want me back on.
Because
I'm not talking about some stupid Flaming Lips album that just panders to a bunch of dumb droney fans. Sheeps to the slaughter, I say.
I'm just gonna let you rant for the rest of the podcast. How about that?
Well, hey,
no,
Eric,
no,
floor,
I don't want to be.
The floor is yours, Eric.
I don't
want to.
No, I'm not an attention hog, and I don't want to be a dick. But I'm just sick of stuff like that.
But you just think the Flaming Lips are awful, right?
It's not that, because they're not awful. They're not awful, but it's like you did a 6-hour song. Good on you. Awesome. Attaboy. And then it's like, oh, derp, we're going to do a 24-hour song. Like, just shut the fuck up, Wingcone. Like, people, like, writers and listeners are wasting their fucking time with that shit. Like, go listen to, like, something you haven't heard of. Like, god damn it.
That's true. Like, why would you listen to 24 Hours of the Flaming Lips when there's so much else to be discovered?
Like, the average guy is gonna go on Pitchfork, and he's gonna read the headlines. You know, he's gonna read the front page. He's not gonna scroll. He's gonna maybe scroll down to see tracks. You know what? He's gonna see a big fucking headline about how he can go listen to some stupid Flaming Lips song. And it's like, go listen to something else.
Someone who listens to the whole of the 24-hour Flaming Lips song is like the bro of the indie world. It's like chugging a lot of beer to impress someone. It's the equivalent.
But that's the thing. Like, who does listen to the whole thing?
No, it's not the listening that pisses me off. It's the fact that it exists, and it's the fact that, like, the band thought it was a good idea. Like, why would they ever think, like, that's a good idea? And the whole gummy thing. Don't get me started on this whole, like, gummy thing. Ugh. Gag.
I have no idea what that is.
Oh, we put a USB stick in a gummy vagina. That's real, real cool. Real cool.
Yeah, that's...
Had three new tracks on it. None of them were good.
Yeah, awesome. You know what the best thing they've ever done? Is with another band I hate. Neon Indian. That album was good. That little EP thing they did. You know what? Good. Good on them.
Why did you listen to it if you hate both bands?
The two negatives
canceled each other out.
No, it leaked when I was on the internet one night, and we got a bunch of hits from it, so good on me. But
actually, you know what it seems like? This era of Flaming Lips just seems like all the shit that they ever were like, we should do that. Let's do a fucking
But why would they ever think that? Why would they ever think, let's do a gummy mold of a vagina and put a USB stick in it? That's not, it's not funny, it's not creative, it's not anything.
No, I agree, but at the same time, it just sounds like things that they were like, okay, we want to do a 6-hour song, we want to do a 24-hour song, and they're like, all right, we have to actually do this. And then the next album that they do is just going to be Flaming Lips back again, great as ever. I mean, do you not like Soft Bulletin or Pink
Robots? They're fine, I've listened to them, they're alright, but I've probably listened to like, Soft Bulletin and Yoshimi and those albums like 3 or 4 times a piece. I mean, enough to get the Flaming Lips. Oh, cool, I saw Wayne Cohen in a ball rolling over the crowd. Like, awesome.
So it's not...
I get it, but it just pisses me off with all this other stuff. Like, just do your music. Like, don't... I don't want the other stuff.
Third segment, Rob is going to tell us a little about this NPR article that we're going to be talking about.
Right, there's this blog on NPR called The Record where they talk about all kinds of, they do kind of more in-depth articles about the music industry. And they've got this article up, the headline is, Has Indie Become Adult Contemporary? Both Indie and Adult Contemporary
Quotes.
Yeah, you know what I mean. In quotes. So basically, it's about whether the music that we once considered indie, which doesn't mean things on indie labels, it means like kind of alternative. I guess they kind of mean alternative music. Has that become adult contemporary? Because I guess NPR now plays almost exclusively things like Wilco, Feist, and Radiohead, which are the three bands they keep bringing up in this article. And NPR has always kind of been considered adult contemporary music, and they kind of give the example of adults driving their kids around in the car listening to Wilco, and their kids will get fed up with it because they'll think it's like dad rock, which is the label Wilco always gets, and it's mostly about, I guess, has indie become adult contemporary? Is it for adults? Is it not cool for kids anymore?
And the thing that like I remember reading from the article was. Is like indie kind of playing it safe with like selling records at like Starbucks and like that kind of angle to their output. And
yeah, they talk a lot about indie being safe now and not really trying any experimentation.
So I take quite the offense with this article. for only because I feel like their definition of indie is super, super broad. I think, like, we were talking a little bit about this before we started recording, and the way they use indie reminds me of kind of how my friends that don't really listen to music all that intently use indie, which is to reference bands like Feist, Radiohead, and Wilco, who truly, I mean, maybe Feist is on an indie label, but, and obviously Radiohead.
Feist is on Interscope.
Okay, so she's, and Wilco, what label is Wilco on?
Wilco have their own label now.
Okay, so
but I think, yeah.
So, but the point is, like, those three bands have kind of already been out. They've already managed to kind of exceed the limitations of indie record labels, which is when I use the term indie, it might apply to bands that aren't signed to indie labels, but at the same time, it applies to this kind of nebulous conceit of bands that exist within that realm. And it's sort of, I guess it sort of breaks down if you start going that route. But at the same time, I feel like I wouldn't call those three bands, maybe Feist, but I wouldn't call those three bands, which is ironic because it's the only major label band of those three. I don't know, I'm kind of rambling at this point, but
I think at this point, indie basically is just a catch-all for anything that Pitchfork reviews.
I think that's true.
You think so?
But yeah.
Yeah, and what's wrong with that?
Well, I mean, I don't know, because I think indie applies to things that maybe are too small for Pitchfork to review as well, or whatever cover.
Well, yeah, but I think it includes them as well. I think saying that it's everything that Pitchfork covers doesn't necessarily exclude them, which kind of doesn't make any sense, but.
So you mean,
there needs to be a new category that goes beyond indie, like the stuff that's even more, like, alternative or diverse or whatever.
Yeah, like the dumb shit that I listen to.
Yeah, that kind of dumb shit. And the kind of, yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, the term indie doesn't really have a very specific meaning, I guess. And it kind of means something in my head when I'm like indie music, when I say indie music. And I guess anything that Pitchfork reviews you could consider that. But at the same time, Pitchfork reviews, like, you know, they just reviewed Coldplay, and I consider Coldplay the antithesis of what the fuck indie is. So I don't know.
When Coldplay came out, they would have definitely been called indie. Don't you think?
Were they?
I don't know, in the UK at least they were.
They're always the most corporate of corporate rock, I thought. Maybe that's just my.
I think Coldplay's indie. I think indie's a sound.
I think indie is a market now, which I think is another thing it says in the thing. Like, they talk about how major labels like to try and market some of their more alternative acts as indie, and they try and get them put on Pitchfork and blogs like that. Because there's
like
a whole separate
market.
Yeah, like Lana Del Rey, because there's a whole separate market there that they can buy into.
Which doesn't really make sense, because, like what we were talking about last week, like, that market is so small and specific. I don't understand why there are bands.
But in this time when no one buys records, like,
that's true.
Like, indie, there are people who think, say, I'm an indie fan, and they go buy what they call indie records.
But I disagree with what Eric said, which is indie's a sound. Like, I feel like, I mean, that's kind of like what I was referring to before when, like, I feel like a lot of people who say indie definitely mean it as a kind of like a rock sound. But when I say indie, which is obviously the most important of people saying it, I in turn, like, include hip hop and electronic and
see, yeah, that's where I'm different. Like, I would never say, like, The Weeknd is indie.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know. R&B, to me, it's a sound. Like, it's not. It's like what Coldplay is. It's Coldplay. It's like Modest Mouse. It's bands like the Flaming Lips. Like, I don't know. Like, there's, like, I get that they're certainly like different sounds, but
anything guitar driven with hooks.
Yeah, dad rock.
That isn't like Nickelback or something like so mainstream that.
Well, yeah, yeah. It's like basically what like Coldplay or Arcade Fire. And then, like, down from there, what they do, that sound.
Yeah, Coldplay is, like, the absolute, like, maximum of like mainstream that a band can be and still be considered indie to like the general populace, I feel like.
That sort of bugs me that indie doesn't. I mean, I guess you guys are totally right in that it does refer to a sound. I find it sort of egregious that it has be. I mean, it's like punk calling, you know, stuff that has nothing to do with kind of like what punk is, as you know.
Basically, calling like a band like Good Charlotte punk just because like they have piercings and mohawks.
Yeah.
Yeah. These words Indian punk did once mean something in the 70s and 80s, but now they just become so ubiquitous and homogenized, and they mean nothing now. They get attached to everything that they're almost meaningless.
Yeah. That's kind of how I feel about it when it refers to sound. It is kind of meaningless. It doesn't really say anything about the sound. It's kind of a lazy kind of just like, oh yeah, that's indie. Whereas like, I feel like Coldplay and Flaming Lips could not be more different as like the music sounds or whatever.
Like the quintessential indie band, as far as I'm concerned, where probably the term indie became most popular is the Smiths. Like, that is an indie sound, and they were on an indie label up until their last album.
Right.
And I think that's like, when I think indie, I think anyone who sounds kind of like the Smiths, like guitar-driven with hooks.
Do we feel like indie is becoming adult contemporary, though?
That's good.
What does that even mean? What does that mean?
I don't even know what, yeah, what's adult contemporary? Does it mean music made by adults for adults? Is that what it means?
Well, I felt like the kind of point of the article was that safe was the safe kind of point, that it's playing very, it's dad rock, or where it's like inoffensive.
Dad rock is the single worst moniker ever invented for music.
I agree. I hate dad rock. It pisses me off.
That's why it's such a stigma, though, you know?
Do you like Wilco?
I love Wilco. We're not talking about
we
don't like the music that's considered dad rock. I just hate that as a term.
Yeah.
I think it's so dismissive and ignorant.
But that the main point is indie adult contemporary. I totally disagree. Like, I feel
who
like
who cares? Here's the point. Who cares? Who cares if it's adult contemporary? Like, would you rather it be like, who cares? Wouldn't you rather be adult contemporary than it be like, oh, is indie the new like top 40? Because like those are the records that are being bought. Like,
sure, but I feel like adult contemporary, the stigma that specific to the article, because yeah, I mean, in the end, who does care? But specific to this article, I feel like they mean it's just kind of like fringe kind of rock that, you know, is very, you know, has a very certain audience and blah blah blah. And I feel like
I kind of think what they're saying is young people buy music made by young people, and all the bands who made indie were once young and they have grown up, and so is their fan base, and now we're all adults, so it's like adult contemporary now. It's what's played on the radio, and it's what's, you know,
yeah, it's like,
written about in magazines.
But Twilight has indie quote unquote music like Bon.
But they're all like quite new bands on Twilight.
What about Bon Iver has only been out for a couple of years, and you know, don't you think? I feel like his album just sort of sounds like a Phil Collins album, basically.
Yeah, I'm not even gonna touch this one.
Well, that last song is definitely Phil Collins.
That whole album is just a joke. Like, everybody in the music industry is just getting punked. Like, he's just in like 5 years, he's just gonna be like, dude, I got you guys so good on that Bon Iver one. I got you guys
it's
so
the
good.
It's the Kanye bounce. Anybody affiliated with Kanye gets
bonus.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, I legitimately and genuinely gave that album a good score. Like,
that's fine, and so did everybody else, but you're all getting played. Like, that album is not good.
Why not?
It is. Okay. One, Beth. Okay, Beth Rest in and of itself is just like this rambling, nonsensical, like uninteresting, just POS of a song. And the whole album, like, it takes everything that was like good about Bon Iver or Bon Iver, however you say it. I don't really know.
Bon Iver.
Like, it took like this artist that had like a heart and soul and like a story and just made it into like, I don't want to say it was like kind of what Sean was saying, that it's just like cashing in on like this hype that was built around like Kanye West and all this stuff, but it doesn't it took everything that I liked about Bon Iver. Like, I stood front row at one of his concerts and, like, legitimately cried. Like, it was amazing, and it, like, moved me because, like, I saw myself in those songs. And it just made it something that just sounded just stupid and, like, silly. Like, it was, like, not even, like, in an ironic sense. It was just awful.
But I feel the same way you do about a song like Calgary. Like, that song is amazing and is, like, emotionally destructive to me. I mean, it's all suggestive at a certain point, but, I mean, subjective, but I don't know. I feel like his vocals and the vocal melodies behind that album are great, but, like, I don't know. I'm not gonna, because I feel like I'm actually the one who's harping on Bon Iver, and most of the time I talk to people about him, so I feel weird defending him, and I'm not going to, so.
So we've concluded that the terms indie and the terms adult contemporary are stupid. Well,
there's no way to define them, certainly, but I don't know. I'd rather indie become adult contemporary than indie become, like, top 40.
Mainstream.
Yeah. Not in, like, a, like, weird sense of, like, ownership over music that I like. I just would rather not have that stigmatism attached to it.
I'm still a little confused, though, because, like, people do consider Bon Iver indie as, like, a sound. Like,
yeah, he is. I would say he's indie.
But, and he's appearing, I mean, didn't he have a song in Twilight? Yeah.
There are lots of, like, indie bands. Like, indie sound, or, like, indie in, like, the sense of, like, kind of underground. Like, I don't know, Tom, like, Battles had a song in there. Like, who listens to Battles, really? I mean, let's be real.
You love Battles.
I do. I mean, everybody kind of likes Battles, but it's like, why is Battles doing a song on, you know, the Twilight album?
Yeah, I guess those are sort of just weird choices to begin with. I don't know. I can't speak for the
apparently people. It's because the writer of Twilight likes all those bands because they're adult contemporary.
All right, then there's my answer.
What's her name? Stephanie Meyer? Is that her name? She is reportedly a fan of, like, Grizzly Bear and all those kinds of guys.
All right, so yeah, then I guess NPR is right. I mean, but who cares? Is that kind of our consensus?
That's NPR's our consensus.
Right, but NPR's right, but who cares? I can go with that.
It's not actually NPR's opinion. It's some ex-Pitchfork writer.
Ann Powers, isn't it?
Yeah. It's well, the article
love Ann Powers. Ann Powers is one of my favorite writers in the world, but
no, it's the article itself is by Franny Kelly.
Oh, it is. I just got confused because the record, I think Ann Powers is who runs.
Yeah, she's like, well, I don't know. On the site, it lists her as host. Apparently, the record is a show or something.
Ann Powers is one of my personal heroes as far as music writers go. So I'm.
You guys, while we wrap this up, we do have a question from Twitter. Somebody has a question.
Give the Twitter handle. Give him a plug.
Okay, so our handle, of course, is 130BPM. Maybe from now on, your gracious host will take questions from the audience. So we're doing this sort of impromptu, so we only have one question. But the question is from AJ_SN_. And he asks, how do you decide which albums and tracks to review and which not?
I mean, I put together a list of all the stuff I think we should be covering based on what people have been talking about, what I've heard and what I like, what our other writers have been talking about. I get them off the labels and I put them into a list, and then I put it out there and I see who wants to review what, and it's basically as simple as that. And anyone can come along and say, I want to review this. I mean, people like Josh Becker reviewed a ton of random crap that I'm never going to listen to, but I'm happy to publish it.
Yeah, so we
personally, I usually take last dibs, which is why I ended up with Florence and the Machine this week, because I kind of thought we need a Florence and the Machine review, and even though I didn't know that much about her, I thought I would review it because it seemed like something we needed.
I just review whatever Rob and Phil think I like, which is... which is usually, like, weird fringe kind of stuff.
All right, have you listened to that Blouse album yet?
Just once. But yeah. I had heard some of the stuff leading up to, like, hearing the whole album. But, yeah, I don't know. Like, I just... I just review whatever I like. Like, there are a lot of albums I would love to pan and just totally trash, which you've probably figured out by now, but I'd rather review an album.
We don't let him go near that stuff.
Yeah, like I wrote and submitted a whole tennis review and then just never got published. Uh-oh. But we'll do that. That's the blooper reel coming at the end of the year. But
that was before I was in charge.
But I don't know. I'd rather just review something I like, you know. I don't know.
Even if it's something I don't like, if it's something I actually have an opinion about, I'll review it.
Yeah, if I listen to something, sometimes I'll listen to something and instantly I'll have an opinion about it. I'm like, I want to write about this, so I just claim it. Sometimes I listen to stuff and I just don't have – I have lots of thoughts about it, but they don't become like sentences in my mind instantly, which makes it harder to review.
All right, I'm gonna call this one because we've been going forever.
People love it though.
People hate it, man. Yeah, but we should do user questions. I guess we should field them.
Yeah, now that we're on iTunes, maybe some people stumble upon us.
Yeah. All right, that's been the 130 BPM podcast. If the quality was not good again, I apologize. We're trying to get that worked out ever slowly. So we will see you next Thursday. For now, that's been our little podcast. Say goodbye, guys.
Peace.
Goodbye. Protecting serves.